Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
You're listening to the Aramco 2022 F1 Car Reveal Series. The race is on, and AlphaTauri has done what its big brother team Red Bull didn't and actually produced a real car for the launch of the AT03. Although it was only in the form of renders with some aspects hidden, it at least gives us an idea about the new car and also a few hints about what to expect from the RB18. I'm Ed Shaw, and joining me to analyse the latest 22 F1 car are Mark Hughes and Gary Anderson. Well, Mark, a low-key but functional launch from AlphaTauri that at least gives us some idea about the car, even if there probably is scope for more detail in the real thing.
Yeah, there's some detail around the floor and the rear suspension, which is either disguised or missing altogether, but we will get a general idea of the layout at least, and it's quite a bit of detail on the front, and it looks for a pretty neat little car. I think we have to take it on faith that this is more or less what the real car will look like, because it will be appearing tomorrow in testing. So, it's yet another variation, the fourth real car, or the fourth, genuine representation of the cars that we've seen so far. And yet again, it's slightly different again. So definitely we're seeing a lot of variation and the early interpretation of these new regs, which is a good thing, I feel.
And Gary, it does seem like it's a little bit of a midpoint between what we've seen from Aston Martin and McLaren in some aspects.
Yeah, it is. I think it's quite interesting to see that. As Mark says, we're seeing some variation between the cars. I mean, the thing is, the regulations are so predictive. They are, every point's already laid out. You can alter some things, some places. So if you are not a car fan necessarily, and you're just looking at these as individual pictures, you would struggle a little bit to see too much difference in them. But there is very well-detailed, subtle differences between them. And that's going to be important because, way back, in the early 90s, certainly, you could go to the wind tunnel for a couple of days and you'd find 2%, 3%, 4%, 5% more downforce just by, scratching your head a little bit and changing a few bits and pieces. And that's diminished as the years have gone by. And again, it's the same from last year to this year. It's diminished. So it'll be the same, same development process to try and achieve bits and pieces, but the details so much less, the opportunity is so much less, and the detail has to be so much more important. So it's just small things that makes a difference, and I quite like it, especially the side pod arrangement. And that, as I say, it's a compromise between what Aston Martin have come up with and what McLaren have come up with, but it's a good solid compromise. It looks functional to me.
Well, let's talk about the side pods in a bit more detail. As you say, it is that compromise in that they're the cutback side pods, as it were, but there's still enough there for that to be that kind of downwash area towards the back that feeds it into the top of the diffuser area. There's none of the cooling louvres we've seen on the Aston Martin, so it's like the McLaren in that regard. But do you think it's a question of this is a good compromise, it's taking the best of both worlds, or do you think we might see a little bit more cleverness here with the real car?
You're not going all out one way. In your design package, the whole objective of the car is to basically get airflow into the leading edge of the underfloor and allow the diffuser to work as hard as possible. And to do that, you can't force air into that area. You have to suck it into that area. So you have to give it the best opportunity possible. You have to open up all the volume around the front of the car there. So you have your radiator cooling requirement, And obviously they've minimized that as best they can, in the fact that it's got the top edge of it is as high as you can put it. And then that allows them to put the bottom edge up high as possible. And they also want to try and keep that outer edge from getting involved in the tire wake. So, you know, you end up with this rectangle shape now, which is completely different from the past. But the main aim of that is to allow the leading edge of the floor to sit out in the middle of nowhere. So it's not getting any sort of involvement with any of the rest of the flow. It's open to doing its own thing and allow the diffuser to suck the airflow through there. But in doing that, you also are making the top of the diffuser suck the airflow through the top of it. So the leading edge of the underfloor is an independent piece of kit sitting out there with airflow being sucked over the top of it and underneath it. So it's free to take whatever airflow it wants. The direction of the airflow is quite important, but that's coming off the wishbones. So the fact you have a big undercut on the side pods and that opens through the car to the, as I say, the coke bottle area or the top of the diffuser, the airflow over the top surface is just as important as the airflow under the bottom surface. One of them's giving you downforce and the other one's just enhancing that downforce by having an open hole so the airflow doesn't get pushed around the car in certain directions. And then they've made the treatment with the side pod where they brought the top of it down and in as well. So they've sort of got the best of both worlds from it, I suppose you might call it. They got the undercut tunnel, they got the flow over the top of the side pod going down into the same area, and then neatly they brought a sort of T slot shape out of the top part of the side pod to be their radiator exit. The radiator exit looks quite big on it to me. The radiator inlet's not small. So I imagine that inside of there the flow through the radiator is quite complicated, and they're trying to sort of introduce a little bit more air to it and get a little bit more air through the radiator. I can see their radiator exits getting smaller as time goes by, and maybe some of the louvers appearing on the top surface, which you're allowed now. And that can be a tuning device for different ambient temperatures and different circuits. But as a general thing, I like the trend of, if you took those side pods or the radiator intakes off there, you've got an underfloor sitting out in free air. It's got its own leading edge, it's got its undersurface, and it's got its top surface. It's quite an efficient-looking looking package.
If I could just interject there, Gary, when you look at the implication of the cooling package of that car compared to the two Mercedes ones that we've seen, it does look as though they've been able to package it a bit more tightly. It doesn't seem to take up as much bodywork. Is that, you think that's a reflection of the heat rejection of the two engines?
Yeah, I think it is. It's also, it's always difficult because you basically flow a certain amount of air through a given radiator size. So it depends on how the package of the radiator in there. Obviously, the radiator is, it must be lying at quite a shallow angle. It must be quite a long radiator. We probably will never see that because we never really see the bodywork off these cars. But I look more at the inlet size and the exit size. On this car, it looks quite big, I suppose you might call it. It's not small. And that can be good because, if you go around your car trying to make it efficient and produce downforce, you can easily con yourself by having far too small a radiator inlet and far too small an exit, because the more airflow you use to generate downforce, the less airflow you have for cooling, and vice versa. So it's very easy to con yourself, and then you get to somewhere like Bahrain or whatever, ambience up in the mid-30s, and suddenly you're cutting holes in the bodywork. So it's better as a team of their size, especially AlphaTauri, to go the other way and make sure the cooling is adequate. And I think the heat rejection figures probably from the Honda are pretty good, but I think the radiator exit area, I think, well, you can see it getting shut down a little bit, but we won't know really until we see the cars, I suppose, in competition, you might call it. Barcelona won't really be a good indication because it'll probably be struggling to get anywhere near 20 degrees there, but it's a very neat package, and I'd love to see underneath the bodywork to see how well it is detailed and executed, but I like the look of it visually from the outside.
Not to ask if you can have a rummage around in the garage in Barcelona. Let's hope they'll let you take a proper look. You normally catch a few glimpses of things you shouldn't, though, so I'm sure you'll get some details. While we're towards the back of the car, though, let's talk a little bit about the rear suspension. The launch images have hidden some of the rear suspension detail, but it is effectively our first look at a bit of the Red Bull RB18, because as well as using the Red Bull badged Honda power unit, AlphaTauri also uses the Red Bull gearbox, hydraulics and rear suspension. So that's all 2022 spec stuff. So what can you glean from that, Gary?
It does look like the rear lower wishbone is very high. I mean, there's been this thing that Mercedes did about getting the wishbone legs further rearwards on the 2020 car to try to reduce the blockage through there, through that area of the coke ball. And that's still important. You know, the blockage there just slows the airflow down. And basically, whenever you're trying to produce downforce from air flowing over the car surface, the last thing you want to do is slow it down. So it looks as though they've gone for a very high lower wishbone, getting it away from the higher diffuser. Still the pull rod suspension, which, you know, in the pictures we've got, the pull rod is a very small cross-sectional area. So there's no big blockage there. It's also round, which is quite good, because although you could make a better flow across an aerodynamic shape of that size, it would only be better with the flow attacking it at one angle. So having a round rod is not quite as good aerodynamically, but it's more robust to different airflow regimes, which will, you know, that will change through there with the car's rear ride height going up and down. The flow through that area will alter its angle where it's coming from. So we can't quite pick the drive shaft out in the pictures we've seen yet. Or if we have picked it out, then it's not on the wheel centre line, which is a bit strange. And as I say, maybe they've got a see-through drive shaft. But again, we need to wait to see the complete car. But the initial packaging of it looks to me, it's okay. They've got the top wishbone with a forward leg lower than the rearward leg, from what we see. It's got some anti-lift in it. So basically, that with the geometry like that, it'll stop the rear of the car from rising up under braking quite as much as it wants to, I suppose you might call it, because of the way the loads go through the suspension, which is good, because that helps the rear of the car to get grip under braking whenever you hit the brake pedal initially, because these cars create so much downforce that one of the things you want to do is do as much of your braking as possible immediately. So you stump the brake pedal as hard as you can while the car's got that downforce. And as you're slowing down, obviously the grip is reducing, so your ability to brake is reducing as well. And that, you know, anti-lift on the rear suspension is quite good for that, to stop that happening. So, it's all there. If it is an example of what the Red Bull's going to be like, then, you know, we've got something pretty neat and tidy in that area.
And Mark, we assume this is an accurate representation of what will be the Red Bull rear suspension. So, do you think if you're McLaren, they'll be getting a little bit worried that they're out on their own with the pushrod at the rear? Because we've seen the Mercedes rear suspension that's on the Aston Martin. That's pull rod. McLaren's gone pull rod. They do their own gearbox, so they add some flexibility there. It looks like the Red Bull teams have gone pull rod. So it looks like McLaren's going to be a bit of a minority on the rear suspension.
Oh, yeah, maybe even unique. But I just see you just have to have confidence in your own reasons for doing something. And, you know, they've probably attacked it from a different perspective, trying to get a slightly different thing and a characteristic that they're looking for. I doubt very much whether it will be one layout's right and one's wrong. But yeah, it's probably making them a little bit nervous as I see more and more new cars coming out retaining the pull rod, which has been the convention for the last, since 2010, really. Adrian put it on the 2009 Red Bull and everybody had it the following year. So everybody stayed with that apart from McLaren, who swapped. So yeah, I'm sure there'll be a little bit of concern there, but I doubt whether it'll be serious, because they will have their own very clear reasons for doing that.
The one thing I just add into that area is the diffuser on these new cars is narrower than the old cars. The old cars, the diffuser was sort of swept out to the width of the inside of the rear tires to try and get the low pressure area behind the tire to help the diffuser work. These diffusers are a bit narrower, so there's some very decent sort of ski ramps, I think you might call them, mounted on the inside of the rear brake drums the old cars had the same thing. Last year's cars had the same thing, but not to the extent of these ones. And that area is basically generates very good downforce. It's downforce directly onto the unsprung weight, which means that the load that they create goes directly into the tire. It doesn't go through the suspension before it gets to the tire. And whenever I say it goes through the suspension, that downforce that's created on the sprung part of the car means that whenever you're braking, the car's moving. You know, that downforce is changing because of the movement, never mind the load. The load might stay the same, but the damping becomes much more critical because you've got the downforce on the sprung part and that's moving. So if you have, let's say, high rebound, you're unloading the rear tire quite a bit initially because you get weight transfer in these cars when you're braking. So having these ramps on the, or turning vanes, whatever you like to call them, on the inside of the brake duct is a big thing because, as I say, the load goes directly onto the contact patch. It doesn't move around while you're braking. It's there all the time. And that, I think, is really quite important for, especially on braking, for rear consistency, rear grip consistency. So by having the push rod there, the end of it coming down at the outboard end and up at the inboard end means that it's going across that area where you want that flow to go through on the inside or the outside wall of the diffuser to those ramps. So I'm not a big fan of the push rod just yet on the rear of the car because I can't see the positive of it yet. But, you know, we'll see. Maybe somebody else will come out with it as well and it'll be the big, the magic bullet. But I don't quite see it.
It's interesting, isn't it? I'm looking at the pictures of the Aston Martin testing and how flat it was running. It looks as though these cars are really like the want to be run with no rake or maybe even negative rake. Could you forget, I guess, to get those Venturis working?
It's one of those sort of things. Obviously, if you put more rake into the car, you increase the size of the diffuser, but that's only relative to how much leak you get down the side of the car. I didn't quite pick up a while back that the sides of the floor are now lower than they were before. So there's no 50 mil step there at the outside edge of it. So, you know, although you don't have a skirt, getting that closer to the ground is probably easier to get the downforce out of the underfloor than trying to create some aerodynamic flow that will try to seal the side of the car. Red Bull have sort of been the masters of that over the past few years. So we have to sort of wait and see what they come up with. But on face value now, and understanding what the cars look like a little bit better, I think it's right that you would be interested in getting the back of the car low as quickly as possible. And, you know, that could be a reason to play with what Mercedes had last year as far as the rear ride height, having some type of mechanism that allowed it to be lower quicker, because obviously there's a low speed corners, which having the car a little bit on its nose with the rear up is better because the front grip is there a little bit more. The wing angle, front wing angle is there a little bit better. So you get a bit more front end in the low speed corners. And then if you can drop the rear of the car, the stability and the diffuser starts working harder and the stability of the rear of the car gets better. So a whole new learning curve, I think, for these cars as far as ground effect, maximum use of the ground effect is concerned. It's not just black and white like the old cars. Yes, they've all created downforce over the period of time, but I think there's a learning curve to come with these cars that the teams don't really haven't really gotten top of yet.
You're listening to the Aramco 2022 F1 Car Reveal Series. Aramco continuously push the limits of engineering. As the global energy partner of F1, they drive a shared vision to real-world innovation that aims to lower emissions, enhance performance, and drive ongoing human-led progress. Aramco, powered by Howe.
We haven't talked much about the front of the car, so let's have a little bit of a look at the nose and front wing, Mark. It's maybe a more literal interpretation of the front wing than we've seen from some of the others. The main plane, the bottom plane, is mounted directly onto the nose. We haven't got the lowest part sort of suspended off the second element as we've seen with some of the other cars. So do you think that's for real, or is it hiding a real design, do you think?
I don't know. The front wing's always the one that you're not sure about whether it's a render or whether they've got something else entirely. But yeah, I mean, it looks in terms of the profile of the elements themselves, it's sort of quite similar to McLaren's in that way. It's got a sort of a, I guess you call it a seagull wing shape, and it tapers down quite sharply at the outboard ends. And the difference on what they presented anyway is the nose tip sort of stands proud of the first element. But let's wait and see. We see some spy shots of the real car.
What do you make of it, Gary? Because you can make a case for taking that slightly more orthodox approach, can't you?
Yeah, I like the idea of what Aston Martin and Mercedes or McLaren have come up with, and the fact they've got that slot gap right across the front of it to act as a sort of leading edge slat, which means that the flow through the middle of it, underneath the nose profile, through the middle there, helps the center of the car get more airflow through into the underfloor. It could be a missed trick by Alfa Romeo because it's not a common thing by any means, just because two cars have done it. But it's something that I like the idea of, because as I say, it's you get stagnation on the front of the wing. The airflow has to decide when the car's coming at it, the airflow has to decide where the air's going to split and go over the top of the wing and go underneath the wing. And basically when you get that piece in the middle, it's got the wing and it's got an opening underneath it, and then it's got the nose connected to it. So the blockage there is much greater than on the Aston Martin or the McLaren. And the fact that the airflow could decide on the front wing what it wants to go through the slot gap, what it wants to go underneath it. And the second flap on the Aston Martin and Mercedes was the mounting of the wing, really, and that connected up to the underfloor, the under nose surface. So that was like a continuation of that nose surface dropping into the secondary flap, pulling air through that slot gap. So I think the airflow in the middle of the car on both those other two cars would be a little bit better, tidier than the airflow on this car. And I think that's also why the inner part of the front flaps looks like it's got a bit more angle on it, because they're trying to use that to pull the airflow back in underneath the nose. I mean, obviously you've got these cars coming along here. You've got a wing that's 2 meters wide, and you want to use the maximum of that you can. And then you've got these two big front wheels coming at you, and that's just displacing flow. So the gap between the inside of the two wheels and the chassis is still basically the gap that the airflow can get through, and then you've got underneath the chassis. And as I say, I think the McLaren and the Aston Martin are better at bringing more airflow through underneath the chassis than this. But it's a small percentage, you know. It's not a massive make or break of it, but if I was AlphaTauri and I'd seen the Aston Martin and the McLaren, I would be heading into a little bit of a research program on if you put a slot gap through there and separated the nose. But that's a big thing to do, you know. It's easy enough to come up with a solution, but again, it could mean crash tests and all sorts of stuff. So it's not a quick fix if it is a good, you know, if it is a positive. And I think it might just be a positive.
Well, you never know. They might be so quick. They've got one to run on the car tomorrow at Misano, just like that. Although I think that will have been a bit of sneakiness on their part. Were there any other things about this car that caught your eye, Gary?
Well, it's hard to decipher whether what's real and what's not real. You can see the splitters in the leading edge of the underfloor. There's obviously the outside splitter, which, you know, I've sort of christened the replacement barge board as such, because you're trying to get the flow to go around the outside of that and separate the flow that's going under the floor from the wake behind the front tires. And then inside of there, there's also two more splitters, vertical splitters as such. Not quite vertical, but close to vertical. And they're very, very powerful because they turn the airflow out. On last year's cars, if you imagine, we had all those little turning vanes and that in the turned up section on the edge of the floor. And this year's car is no different. I mean, you want to take as much airflow in there as you can and then manage it. So you want some of that airflow to be turned outwards, which helps seal the side pod because you're putting airflow outwards. So while you're able to do that, there's no airflow coming inwards. So basically the diffuser is working mainly working on the area between the two inner vertical turning vanes. So that's that column of air in the middle. And then that gets accelerated underneath the car, down through the tunnels and into the diffuser. So those turning vanes can be quite powerful, and you can see there's a curve on them. They head outwards at the trailing edge, but the detail of it we can't see, obviously. my main thing with this car is the simplicity and the lack of having to be too imaginative on the side pod arrangement, I suppose. It's just, it looks pretty good. And as I say, in my column about it, I've sort of related it to a dolphin swimming through the water. You know, there's no turbulence comes off it. And that's really what a racing car is. You want to get the cross-sectional area of the car diminishing as you go rearwards. And that's very difficult because of the rear wheels, because they're a fixed cross-sectional area. The front wheels are a fixed cross-sectional area. So you've got to try to sort of exploit that flow and make sure that it's able to expand as it goes rearwards and get pulled through there faster, just because that's what air wants to do. And I think the whole car is a neat and tidy concept, to be honest.
And Mark, AlphaTauri has specialised in neat and tidy concepts with quite sensible, pragmatic decisions made under technical director Jody Egginson in recent years. That's helped them improve nicely. 16 times last year, they had a car in the top six fastest in qualifying. Do you think that kind of form is possible this year, given that while it's a good team, it is still one of the smaller teams, and the teams that it's competing with, the McLarens, the Ferraris, Alpines, they're all teams that have got better facilities and are upwardly mobile and kind of should be ahead of them in terms of their raw materials?
Yeah, it's sort of out of their hands, really. It depends whether those big teams have got it right first time, because it could be that just doing a nice, elegant, plain, simple car around the base mechanicals that Red Bull have given you and that you don't need to devote any resource or time to, that might just be a car that's quick straight out of the box, while the more complex ones might, you know, take a while to refine. You don't know. It's sort of out of their hands. But yeah, I mean, last year it was on average the fifth quickest car, but was it within a tenth of a second of being the third quickest car, which was, you know, for a little team and going head to head on pace with Ferrari and McLaren was quite remarkable, really. And had they had not had a rookie not contributing very much to the constructors' score, they would have been in that battle for third in the constructors' championship. So there's still some headroom in what they could achieve, I think. And but whether it's whether these regs have done it a favour or not, it's sort of out of their hands.
Yeah, the thing you're right there, Mark. You know, the cars we've seen at the minute, the Aston Martin, the McLaren, and the AlphaTauri. You know, they are, their hope is they are the best of the rest, because that's really where they should stand, behind the big boys. Now, they're hoping the big boys will consist of Mercedes and Red Bull, if there's such a thing as big boys. We don't quite know where Ferrari will drop into that. Could be in competition with these guys, or it could be in competition with the other two. But, you know, the competition, these three cars that we've seen, and I'm not classifying the Haas in there yet because it's not really the car, and I'm definitely not classifying the Red Bull we've seen in there. But these three real cars that we've seen, or most of them real cars that we've seen, are strongly in competition with each other. And I, you know, they all look good. They all have their positives and their negatives. But I think AlphaTauri, my book, might just have that little bit. Might just have that little bit on the other two, which doesn't need much to just nip in there. And they've shown they can do it, but they haven't quite done it. But, you know, maybe they can read the regulations better. Maybe they have good gut feel. Maybe it's not all about producing data. So I think time will tell, but I like what I see.
Yeah, and we should note, they've also talked about the need to future-proof the design of the car. In fact, that's a phrase James Keir at McLaren also used. And actually, having sort of a sensible design like that should mean that they can take off in whatever direction they want to, development-wise. Everyone's going to be looking very closely at rival cars. So that's going to be quite an interesting thing to follow. So maybe AlphaTauri can do well on that score. But yeah, generally, seem to be quite positive about AlphaTauri. Gary certainly is. Mark, are you quite upbeat as well?
I am, yeah. And it's always a team. It's like the plucky underdog, isn't it? And so it's a lot of feel good when it does well. So yeah, I'm quite intrigued to see how they get on.
I think we should also very, very briefly divert off AlphaTauri just to mention the changes in Formula One that have been announced and agreed. So quickly, Mark, we now know there's going to be three sprint races: Imola, Red Bull Ring, Interlagos, pole position officially will be based on whoever's quickest in qualifying on Friday, and then there's more points. I think it's 8 down to 1 for the top 8. Do you think that's a sensible strategy for this year?
Yes, I do. I think if we're going to have the sprint races, that's the optimum sort of structure for it. And it's correct that the person fastest in qualifying is the setter of pole position and not whoever wins the sprint race. I like that. And yeah, I like the repositioned points also. I think it's a good move.
Yeah, I must admit, philosophically, I'm not keen on points for anything other than the Grand Prix itself, but I do think it's necessary to have those more points for the sprint race in order for it to work. So it's, yeah, sometimes you have to be pragmatic. You can't be purely sticking to a set philosophy on things.
There is three sprint races, as you say. So 8 points for the win, that's 24 points. So it's still less than one win of a main race. So I don't think it's going to really, be a big contender for the championship, that one event, because it'd be very unlikely, to be honest, that one guy will win all three of those races. You never know, but I'm just saying, if it was much more points than that, then suddenly it'd become a dominating factor. It's not. So it's equivalent to one more race in the championship.
Yeah, you're right. It's not changing the game completely. One thing I think, Gary, I'm going to know what your response is to. They've also said, with reference to Spa, that they've changed the rules about points being awarded. So there has to be at least 2 green flag racing laps, so not under the safety car or the virtual safety car, in order for points to be awarded at all. So we couldn't have what happened at Spa last year. And they've also created now 4 different tiers of how much of the race is completed. So if there's between 2 laps and less than 25%, it's only 6 points for a win. The top 5 get points. 25 to just under 50% is 13 for a win, down to 1 for 9th and so on. I won't do the whole breakdown, but they've adopted this sliding scale, which I'm sure was an idea that I read somewhere. Do you remember where, Gary?
I can't remember right now, Ed, but I think I have a clue that I know where it come from, but it is logical. It's very, very easy to work out. We had the full points after 75% race distance, so the sort of precedent was there for something like that. But it's, it's better to have it black and white. X percentage of race, X points, that's it. End of story.
Yeah, just seems like a logical move. And we should say, for those who are waiting for the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix analysis, that was discussed in the commission meeting. There was feedback taken, and there's still some work to be done on that analysis. So in the coming days is when the FIA said we'll get some more on that, so people can continue to discuss and debate that while we wait for that. Well, thanks very much for your insight, Mark Hughes and Gary Anderson. Head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen, as there's loads to read there, including Gary's in-depth technical analysis, not just of the AlphaTauri, but also all the other cars that have been launched. Check out also our sister podcasts. We've got podcasts covering MotoGP, IndyCar and Formula E, as well as Bring Back V10s, which tells classic F1 stories. And if video is your thing, check out our YouTube channel. The launches keep coming thick and fast, so join us tomorrow for everything you need to know about the new Williams FW44. Thanks for listening to the Aramco 2022 F1 Car Reveal Series.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a 1-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.